Hi, everybody. Good afternoon. Thank you very much for coming. I know there are a lot of other very important, impressed, and significant events taking place today, so I really appreciate everyone showing up. As you probably all saw from the signs, the name of today's program is called Balancing Relationships. Our first speaker is Dr. David Pelkovitz. His title is Dating and Courtship. Dr. Pelkovitz is, amongst many other important titles and significant accomplishments, is the professor of education and psychology at Azrieli Graduate School of Jewish Education and Administration. He'll be speaking first for a few minutes, and then our second speaker is Dr. Norman Blumenthal, who will be, his title is The Collegiate Evolving Relationship with Their Parents. Has nothing to do with being intelligent or being in college, just meaning like the college age. I know some people I heard were a little had a misunderstanding about that. But please don't take me and my behavior as an example of his clinical abilities. I'm Avin Yavin. Dr. Blumenthal, amongst also many other significant accomplishments and important titles, is the educational director of the Bella and Harry Wexner Kol Elyon and Smicha Honors Program.
Thank you, Ezra. Okay. What do you say, Beth? It's too many people for a circle, right? What do you think? Nah. People look nauseous when I say that. Okay. Here's the way it's going to work. 20 minutes of me talking about dating. Then Dr. Blumenthal will speak for 20 minutes. Then we'll get discussion going on the two topics. Okay. So let's talk. It's interesting. There are three basic categories I wanted to touch on. One is what matters in terms of dating. What are the predictors? So that's the first thing. So what are the predictors of, like, when you're going out, or if you're trying to set somebody up for that matter, you know, the things like, she wants to go on Aliyah, he doesn't. She comes from one family, he comes from another kind of family. Like, what matters and what doesn't in terms of what psychology research tells us? The other issue I wanted to talk about is what happens if there's some problems. So let's say somebody has a history of some kind of mental illness. Or let's say somebody comes from a very dysfunctional family. What do we do about that? And how should that be handled? Should that be seen as a dark red flag? Or should it be seen as a dark green flag? Is that a positive thing or a negative thing in terms of ways of looking at it? And then the third category that I wanted to talk about is a little bit about... For 20 minutes, I think I'm going to keep it to those two. Okay? I'll drop the third. Okay, number one, what matters? Now, obviously, this is far from a science. And the whole dating issue has gotten a lot more complicated than it used to be, as you all know. There's all kinds of styles of going out. Things are not as clear in our world as they are as they were a generation ago. There's something very easy about a pure shidduch system where the parents do everything, and there's something very easy about a pure, it's up to, go out and party and meet somebody and then live together for 5-10 years and then decide what to do. There's something very easy about that. But it's an unclear time. And the crowd of, especially the kind of crowd that Yeshiva University represents, is one where we're right in the middle. And things are sort of not nearly as clear as they are for other parts of the world. Okay, what's predictable? What is it that we know matters? I'm going to go over four key ingredients in terms of what really matters, more than shopping carts, more than tablecloth more than some of the myths that are out there. Number one, and maybe the most important, is a shared dream. Okay? Sometimes I'll have guys, after the pastoral psychology class Friday morning, sometimes there are guys who come up to me with a nauseous look on their face. And I could tell from the kind of nauseous look on their face. Sometimes I've been doing this now for about 6-7 years since I started in the Wexner thing when that first started. At this point I could tell, he's probably going to talk to me about dating, or somebody's going to talk to me about career planning, or somebody's going to talk to me about some other issue. So there's the dating nauseous look. And when I sit down and talk about somebody who's trying to decide whether to continue going out with somebody, very often the question is, we don't necessarily have a shared dream. You know, I want to go into some kind of rabbinic job, or I want to go into chinuch, and she wants somebody who's going to make a real living. Or I want to live in Israel, and she wants to live in Woodmere, you know, or something along those lines. And that's, I know it's pretty obvious, but it needs to be said. If you don't share a dream, more or less, about where you envision yourself going, it doesn't mean that Israel is the deal breaker necessarily, because very often people aren't sure where they want to go with that, and they grow together and decide together. But it means more or less a shared philosophy, a shared vision, a shared understanding of what both of you have in terms of dreams for the future, how you want to raise your family, more or less how many kids you want to have, more or less what you see yourself as doing in your life. The details could vary with time. But the bottom line is that it's important to be on the same page in terms of dreams. Okay? That matters. That really matters. Very often, though, people get sideswiped a little bit too early. They hear on a first date that they're not on the same page about wanting to live in Israel, and they kill it, when in fact it might have been a very promising relationship where that issue could have been worked out somehow. Or they'll hear about some minor religious differences that mean nothing. You know, little variations on the theme in terms of religious practice, things like she goes to the movies, he doesn't. He wants to have a TV in the house, she doesn't. Those are minor issues that can easily be played out over time. Those aren't deal killers. Those are silly, kind of superficial differences. I'm talking about more major differences about what's on your mattering maps, in terms of like what's front and center in terms of what really matters to you, and in terms of how you want to share a life together. That needs to be on the same page. Number two is there has to be a basic physical attraction. If a basic physical attraction isn't there, then there isn't much to work with. But, to make life a little more complicated, attraction grows with time. The longer a person is married, the more their attraction patterns shift in a good marriage to be attracted to a person who looks like the person you're married to. And the more you have a good relationship with somebody, and the more that they take care of your needs, okay, and are there for you, and love you, and do for you, and are confidants for you, the more you're going to become attracted to that person. So it's a little bit of a complicated issue, but there still needs to be, more or less, at least the possibility that this is somebody you could be attracted to. So if he has a slightly crooked nose, or she has bushy eyebrows, or you know, whatever minor things are there getting in the way, that's something that could always be worked out. But if you feel, after really getting to know the person, that the attraction is absolutely not there, then that might be at least a yellow flag. But remember, attraction grows with time. Attraction grows with the relationship, and attraction changes. Now, I know that's almost like I'm confusing the heck out of you with this, but the bottom line is the attraction does have to be there. If there's no attraction whatsoever, that could be a little bit of a problem, but I don't think you really know, unless it's intense, until you get to know the person a little bit better. Number three is something that some of the people who've heard me talk about this topic have heard me say before, and that's the work of John Mordechai Gottman. John Mordechai Gottman is this guy Bal Tshuva goes around the world with his yarmulke on. He's the leading marital therapy researcher probably in the world. Some of the most respected research on marital therapy around. And lives in Seattle. And has done research to the point that now he could sit a couple down and he says, fight. Get into a fight, guys. And within 7 minutes, he can tell with 94% accuracy if they'll be divorced within 5 years. Okay? Now, he then fixes it, or he tries to fix it. He doesn't just say, oh, go ahead, you're going to be divorced in 5 years. But what he's found about relationships is very, very helpful in terms of understanding dating. Because if, in fact, in a dating relationship, you're dominated by the four predictors that he has of divorce, then you probably should be thinking that this is not meant to be. And what his four, I'm not going to go into all of them for the sake of time, but I'll go into the main issues. Predictor number one is harsh startup. Harsh startup means that when the couple disagrees, they go from 0 to 100 in like about a half a second. So when they sit down and talk, they immediately start yelling and screaming at each other. So when you have a harsh startup, it's going to be problematic. By the way, usually talking about difficult topics in a relationship is initiated by the women. 80% of the time in Gottman's research, it's the women. Not because of any sexist kind of prejudice, but because his research shows he has them hooked up to biofeedback equipment when he has them talk. That the more women talk about what they're upset about, the more their pulse rate goes down, the more their blood pressure goes down, the calmer they become. The more men, as a rule, talk about what they're upset about, the more hyped up they become, the more physiologically aroused they become. So as men are talking, it's not a refuah, it's part of the makala. They get all upset, and it takes them, on average, 2 to 3 hours to calm down. So it's very aversive for the average man to talk about areas that are difficult. It's very healing for the average woman to talk about it. So you have that kind of mismatch. Now, this is related to a major issue in dating, and that's that very often men and women are not trained to understand these basic differences. Men are really different than women, and women are really different than men in some profound, profound ways. Women really are, for the most part, more verbal. Not always, but for the most part. And really do deal with emotions in a very different kind of way. And they really do experience the world differently, but those differences should not be a source of tension and drawing a person apart. As some of you have heard me say, the word nisuin, the Rav Avadya Bartanura says in his Parish on Mishnayos, he says the word nisuin has a very interesting etymology. It comes from this. The differences between man and woman can either become a source of terrible tsaros. It could be a masa. So nisuin has embedded in it the etymology of the word masa, or burden. It also has embedded in it the word mess. That the word was sin and samach mischalfim, the differences between man and woman, if they're overcome, could become a miracle and a banner held high proudly. So you have that dialectic, you have that tension, but the bottom line is that there are going to be differences, and we grow through those differences. Marriage, as the other leading marital therapist says, is the people growing machine. We grow through our tension with one another. And as we're in the trenches growing, we have a tremendous amount of benefit from it. So not only is it not unexpected, not only is it not a bad sign that people have conflict during dating, having conflict during dating is fine. That's fine. It's not a bad sign. As a matter of fact, it could be a sign of a healthy relationship. It's how that conflict is resolved. It's how you heal. So if you have a harsh startup, are you able to heal it? Are you able to, at the end of the day, talk it out, and each of you see things through the eyes of others? Okay? Again, I won't go through his other ingredients for the sake of time, but the bottom line in terms of what we're looking at is if you're going out with somebody for a while, and there's a lot of fighting, and not a very good ability to be able to see things through each other's eyes, that, again, might not be such a great sign. Okay? The key is, can you heal it? If you can't heal it, then maybe it means that this is just not a shidduch that's meant to be. And finally, the last ingredient in terms of what really matters is knowledge. It's that detailed knowledge of each other's lives is the key predictor of long-term success in a relationship. So in study after study on marriages and on dating, they show that a key predictor is really liking each other, having similar interests, being able to talk to each other, where not only do you share dreams with each other, but you have a genuine interest in what the partner is doing. And you know, so that if you're woken up in the middle of the night and you're asked, what really matters to this guy you're getting serious with? What really matters to this woman you're getting serious with? That you've talked enough so that you have detailed knowledge of each other's lives. And what that means is that when you're going on dates, it's not just a matter of going to movies or going to restaurants, but it's what you talk about. It's that at a point that the relationship starts to deepen, that you know a little bit about the innermost issues that really matter. So you'd have discussions about, what's your dream about how you want a Shabbos table to look? What's your vision? What kind of bumper sticker do you want to have in raising your children? Is it Ivy League or die, or is it Lakewood or bust? You know, what's the bumper sticker? Okay? So that you know when you have discussions about things like, what's your vision of sharing possessions? How do you view money? What's a sucker project close to your heart? And also, that you really know what it is growing up that each partner values most about their parents. What's a particular family experience that stands out in your mind? Moments that you most cherish, favorite family vacations. Those are the kinds of deeper things that you need to know about, because the research shows that that kind of detailed knowledge becomes a wonderful foundation to build on in terms of predicting what matters. What doesn't matter? Let me talk a little bit about what doesn't matter. What does not matter clearly is subtle differences in backgrounds. What does not matter is parental profession, what his or her mother and father did for a living. Okay, remember, you're not marrying your in-laws. What doesn't matter is wedding-related conflicts. That does not predict much of anything other than wedding-related conflicts. Okay, and what doesn't matter is, as I said before, is minor religious differences. And very often, people get all bent out of shape about these silly things that have nothing to do with what predicts a good marriage. The thing that really predicts a good marriage is loving each other. I know that's trite. It's understanding each other. It's being able to hear one another with an open mind and an open heart. And as one of the wise writers on this field said, it's really probably the number one predictor of a relationship that's destined to be a good relationship. Here's what he said. The single most powerful predictor of whether one person will like another is whether the other likes that person. That's how I got married. I just remembered, okay? Remember, this happened in your house. I was going out with a woman who I've been married to now for almost 30 years, very, very happily, thank God. And when we went out, we were, I never told the story over before. It's a good story, but you're sitting here, so I'll tell it over. I was going out, and it was fine, but it was totally no chemistry. It was no big deal. You know, it's just like we went out and we had fun, but it didn't go anywhere. So I stopped going out with her, and she stopped going out with me by mutual consent. You know, we went our separate ways and, you know, went out dating with other, you know, dating other people. And I get a phone call from a good friend of mine who had set us up, and he said, you know something, she's dying to go out with you again. She really wants to go out with you again. Wasn't true. Right. I didn't want to embarrass him. This is my brother-in-law, okay? He said, she's trying to go out with you again. Okay. So I said, I really, you know, didn't really go. Well, he said, look, she really wants to give her a chance. She's dying. So I go out with her, and the second time around, it went like a charm. It was wonderful. It was terrific, and before we knew it, we were engaged. And my brother-in-law and sister-in-law have us over at a dinner to celebrate our engagement, have us over to their house, and my brother-in-law looks at me and looks at my then-fiancé and says, you know something? I'm a big liar. I'm a big liar. He had called her up and said that I was dying to go out with her. He called me up and said that she was dying to go out with me. We each thought that the other liked us, and right away, that's what was in it. That's what one of the leading marital therapists says. The single most powerful predictor of whether the person will like another is whether the other likes that person. And if you believe it, now obviously there had to be other stuff there. There had to be the other ingredients. That ingredients were there. But it had to be there in a way that then brought it to the next stage. Let me pull it together. Let's end it. I'd say that one of the major issues that sometimes makes the dating seem a little difficult and has led there, it's a very complex problem in some ways, and it does seem to be on the rise from what I understand the statistics are telling us. But what it boils down to, I often find, is a lack of realistic expectations about what relationships are all about. Okay? What relationships are all about is giving to one another. What relationships are all about is figuring out how to work together as a unit that grows through differences, rather than see them as a sign that things are necessarily bad. And a relationship that basically recognizes that, that the most important thing is to give and to understand and to grow through that. Let me end with a quick story and Bar Torah, and then I'll give it over to my colleague, Dr. Blumenthal. One more, since I spoke about my marriage, one more story. Okay? Remember I said, marriage is the people growing machine. When I first got married, I come from a very Yekisha-like family when it comes to time, okay? You could set your watch by my parents, sort of the way they work things in terms of time. My father is supposed to come to us for dinner at 6 o'clock. He won't come in a minute to 6, because a minute to 6 isn't on time. He won't come a minute after 6. The doorbell will ring as WINS is announcing that it's 6 o'clock. Okay? Now, who do I marry? I marry my wife comes from this wonderful, wonderful family that has a very liberal attitude towards time. Okay, to them, time is more like a general concept. And they're terrific people, but they just view time, and it's a different dimension than the way I viewed time. So when we first got married, what was the recurring point of conflict was, let's say there'd be a wedding. Let's say the wedding was called at 6:30, and let's say it was a half hour away. I'd be in the car at 6 o'clock, ready to go. It's exactly a half hour. I know it's exactly a half hour. We walk in at exactly 6:30. And, of course, at 6 o'clock, my wife was just beginning to think about what dress to wear. Okay? And that was obviously what we had to learn how to do. What's happened over the last 30 years or so? What's happened is that I've become much more relaxed about time, which is good for me. I needed to become more relaxed about time. Okay? It's good for me not to even show up at the smorgasbord, let alone to be there early, as the door is open. And she has learned to meet me halfway and to come. So now we leave in time to make the last, for me to sit down at the chassan's tish and to make the last 10 minutes of the smorg or so. And it's perfect. So she grew in an area she needed to grow in. I grew in an area I needed to grow in. That's the main issue. The main issue is that's what relationships are about. Relationships are about meeting at the point of differences between men and women. And I'll end with something that many of you have heard me talk about before, and it's the interpretation of the Vilna Gaon on the Pasuk in Mishlei of related to marriage as a people growing machine. Hafsek b'musar al teref nitra kihi chayecha. So what does he say? He says, the pasuk says, hold on to self-improvement, don't weaken. Make it something that you cherish because that's what life is about. And he says, "Ki masha ha'adam chai kedei lishbar mashlo shavar ad heina osa hamida." The purpose of life is to struggle with the areas that we need to struggle with. Because he says, otherwise, lama lo chayim. Otherwise, why even live? So what the Gra is telling us is that at the point that you are struggling with issues that you need to struggle with, which is exactly what marriage is designed to do, not only is that not a bad thing, that's when you're living life to the fullest. And that's what, if we just stayed in our own daladamas, and guys stayed in the YU dorm forever, and girls stayed in the Stern dorm forever, and never had to engage the puzzled world of the opposite sex, we would stay very narrow people. We would not grow in the way that Vilna Gaon is telling us to grow. Marriage and relationships are people growing machines. So when you go out and you keep your eye on the ball in terms of those main ingredients that really matter, as opposed to the Narishkeit kind of stuff that doesn't matter at all, just remember that when you have something that upsets you, it doesn't mean that you end it. It means that maybe it's time to talk it out. And then you see how they talk it out. You see whether they're able to hear you. See whether they're able to, the topic here is balance. So as you've heard me say before, the smicha guys, the word ozen to listen and maznayim the scale is the same etymology. There's something very balancing about listening. And may that be a source of balance for all of you in finding the right person and in keeping up with the topic of balance. I'll call on my esteemed colleague, who's usually he gets a lot more laughs than I do, so I'm looking forward to hearing him, and Dr. Blumenthal. I have
laughter makes up for the lack of content usually. Actually, I wanted, the rabbi of my community used to begin his sermons with, before I speak, I want to say something. So I'd also like to say something. First of all, both David and I have been bred in the tradition of Freud. And one of the basic tenets of Freud is that nothing's accidental. So I'm sort of wondering why David uses an example of a lack of attraction, a crooked nose. So we'll work on that. But somehow or another, though, I do have to also tell a story. David's heard it many times, but I think it's appropriate for being on this panel. A number of years ago, I was involved with a school-phobic child. And as you know, the rule of thumb, or you may know, the rule of thumb with school-phobic children is you got to get them into the building. You got to get them to school. So this was a very entitled 8-year-old, 5-pound girl who was refusing to go to school, and we had a showdown in the principal's office. It was me, her parents, the child, the principals. And I was insisting that she has to go to school. No matter what, in each way she tried to get out of it, I kept insisting, no, you have to go to school, you have to go to school. And finally she had it, she was going to really give it to me. And she started telling me how much she hates me, and how mean I am, and what a bad psychologist I am. And then she figured she was going to come with a knockout punch, and she said, and I'm going to tell all my friends what a bad psychologist you are, and nobody's going to come see you. And I said, that's fine, just remember my name is David Pelkovitz. But it really is an honor to share the podium with Dr. Pelkovitz, and I really have to commend the university in the recent years, all the various people in the area of mental health that they've added, most notably Dr. Pelkovitz, and how enhanced the provision of services have been here and also the opportunities for such presentations. I also want to thank the young college student who orchestrated this. What's his name again? Nasir, I appreciate it, and it really is great to be here. It's an interesting thing about this topic. This is actually the first time I've spoken a few times about the issue of a parent's relationship with older children. And usually I've spoken about it to the parents. This is the first time I'm really speaking to it from the older children. So it's kind of new for me. But just to show you how we don't really address this issue. You know how the Eskimos have 100 words for snow? Well, when I first came up with this topic, I called it parenting your grown-up child. And when there would be these parenting workshops, etc., I'd get 2-3 people in my room, and of course, Pelkovitz would get about 400, and it elicited a tremendous amount of sibling rivalry, but I found that there wasn't much of a response to this topic. And then I found out, as I spoke to people, when they heard the topic, parenting the grown-up child, they thought I was talking about, lo aleinu, a disabled child. Children with the offspring with developmental disabilities and parents having to take care of them. And in actuality, I was really talking about what I want to address today, which is the fact that what do you do when you're parenting normal circumstances? What happens when you're parenting? You're 21-year-old, you're 31-year-old, you're 40-year-old, etc. And kind of hard. We're really in spectacular times. I mean, I can tell you myself that I grew up in a neighborhood where, you know, almost all the parents were immigrants, many Holocaust survivors. In fact, I had one friend who had American-born parents, and once asked his parents, how come they speak English funny? It was a rarity to have a grandparent. I had a grandfather until I was 18 who died a week before his 90th birthday and was healthy until, a month before his 90th birthday, but healthy until about a week before he died. And it was such an anomaly. I mean, he was such a novelty in the neighborhood. And today, it's kind of harder. We have grandparents and great-grandparents, and we have younger and younger people getting married and starting their own life, but still have varying degrees of dependency upon their parents. So what I want to address is that very issue is, How do you relate? How do you handle this kind of parent-child relationship when technically you are actually an adult? So what I'm going to do is, also in the spirit of time and trend, so we have some opportunities for give and take, I want to give it a sort of theoretical overview. I want to talk a little bit about, in a general sense, development and how this fits in. But I want to talk about some very basic things. And I'll sort of raise the questions right now. What do you do when your parents disagree with you or you disagree with your parents? How obliged are you to listen to your parents? Is that kibbut of aim? How do you handle issues of money? How do you handle issues when, let's say, you're already married or close to being married and yet you're financially dependent upon your parents? How do you handle living away from home, maybe being in Israel for a year or two and then coming back, and if not living home again, but being at home more frequently? How do you handle conflict between your parents? These various kind of issues I'm going to try to address in a very pragmatic way. But let's look at it from a general perspective, developmental perspective. And to do so, I'm going to trace back to the very first family in the history of the world. God creates Adam, says, "Tov hayosa Adam levado." Not good for man to be alone. And to quote, actually, Dr. Pelkovitz's father, that's the only time in Tanakh that the word lotov is used, something I heard from him, which is an interesting point. But, so he decides to create Chava. We have the first family. And the Torah, in its inimitable fashion, stops for an editorial comment, and in one pasuk, sums up what is the paradox of childbearing. It says, Al-ken yazovish esaviv esimo, v'davak v'shtod v'hayulu v'atzar echad. And henceforth, a man shall literally abandon, a child shall abandon his parents, attach himself to someone else, which is marriage, and vayula basar echad, that shall be one. And Rashi says, in other words, they will then have a child and start this process all over again. And what's the paradox? It's as simple as this. Suppose you own a very precious item. You own a Mona Lisa, you own a crown jewel. You're going to lock it in a safe, you're going to hold on to it, it's going to become an heirloom, you're going to cling to it. And yet, as many of you probably know, and you will, if not, you'll soon find out, there's nothing more precious to us than our children. And yet, if you do your job right, they leave you. They go on. I mean, there's the old story, some of you may have heard about woman sitting on a park bench with her friend and talking about her 42-year-old son who's home and taking care of her, etc. And she said, but he's seeing some doctor and says that he has something called an Oedipus. The other one says, Oedipus, Schmidipus, as long as he loves his mother. That's not what should happen. We want to, if we do our job right, that the child leaves. Now, this leaving process has two parts to it. One part is a fairly obvious one. They move out. They move in, then they go to college dormitories as a gradual process. Let's say when they're teenagers, they start traveling more on their own, they start having more overnights, and they go away to camp. They go overseas to Israel, they stay in a dormitory, they'll make it married, they move their home. There is a physical leaving. But there's another part that's not as well known, which is probably more important here, and that's what we call in the field individuation. You become your own unique individual. You become a distinct person. And that need is a basic psychological need. We need to be unique. We need to be distinct. In fact, you'll find that settings where the purpose is to torture people, they will actually undo the individuality by making them wear uniforms, by giving them numbers. So places like Lower Lane of prisons, concentration camps, Beit Yaakov, they make you wear uniforms, they take away your individuality. That's a form of torture. So we have a basic human need to become a distinct individual. And that's what's happening, and many of you are still going through this. The other thing that's happened that's important as well, in terms of this individuation process, is that we have created, as I said before, we've created this prolonged dependence, so that it used to be that by the time someone was your age, you were really pretty much finished with that, but now it keeps going on, and it's almost like we've prolonged adolescence. Now, the other thing that's important in this individuation process, which again, Dr. Felkowitz had alluded to, the interesting thing is that for you guys, you're at the juncture in your life where if you think about it, you're going to probably make the two biggest decisions of your life, or probably the two most lasting decisions in your life. You're going to pick a career, and you're going to pick a spouse. So you're here at this juncture where you're becoming your own person, and you're about to make those two huge decisions. And what part do your parents play, and how much should they have a say, and how much should they be involved? So let me talk now some just really down-to-earth concrete points. First of all, ideally, I'm not going to say it always happens there, but now you're at the point where your parents are not going to dictate to you what to do. Nor are your parents going to punish you if you don't listen to them. I mean, it would be very inappropriate at this point that if you decide not to be pre-med, that they send you to your room. Your parents are not going to have that kind of role. So just should they have no say? Should they have nothing to do with it? And I don't think that's quite accurate as well. Your parents are now in a position where they're going to advise you, where they're going to suggest to you. They might even put some pressure on you. But there has to be a recognition as well that these two huge decisions, and other decisions maybe not quite as consequential, are your decisions. You are adults. So you need to take seriously what they have to say. You need to listen to them. They have life experience. They certainly have your best interests in mind. So you need to listen to them. You should seek their advice, but that they don't tell you at this point what to do. And by the way, I'm not here to Poskin, but I think I'm on fairly solid ground here because I've discussed this matter with Poskin. Kibbutz of the aim doesn't mean you have to listen and do everything your parents say you should do. Maybe when you're 6, 12, that's the case. But at this point in your life, I don't believe, I mean, I've been in situations, again, clinically, I'm sure Dr. Felkowitz has, where sometimes a child may have a parent who's unstable or something like that, where they're telling them some fairly bizarre things, and again, if it's a serious from kid, they go, well, kibbutz aveim, I've got to listen to them. And those instances, I know I've discussed it with Poskim when we brought it up to Rabbanim, and there isn't an obligation. But I think in a general sense, you're not, kibbutz aveim means you treat your parents with respect, you're deferential to them, you talk to them in a respectful and in a deferential kind of way. Doesn't mean that they tell you whom you have to marry, or they can't tell you what career you're supposed to go into, or they can't tell you how to spend your summers, or for that matter, what kind of car to buy. You have to listen to them respect, listen to what they say, but they can't order you about at this point anymore. Now, there's another very interesting phenomenon, psychological phenomenon that can take place, and it is inadvertent. I'm not even talking about directly. Many times, parents, without being aware of it, will want their child to do something more for their sake than for the child's. If there's something unfulfilling in their life, let me give a simple example. Suppose there was somebody who his whole life wanted to be a physician. His whole life wanted to be a physician. His parents couldn't afford it. He couldn't afford medical school. So he had to go into business or something like that. And it always gnawed away at him that he didn't become a physician, he didn't become a doctor. Now he wants you to become a physician. Now maybe he wants you to become a physician because it's a good career. Maybe he wants to become a physician because he knows you have a knack for sciences, etc. But it could be, and it may be unconscious, that he wants you to become a physician because he wants you to fulfill his dream. Or maybe he wants it because, and it's a very tempting thing to the parents, and I can tell you myself, sometimes you're inclined to look at your children's successes or God forbid their failures as your own. I learned, thanks to Ezra, I learned not to do that. But no. But it's not. It's not. So sometimes there can be pressure on you to make a decision from the parents, not necessarily because of what's good for you, but because of something of their own, some unfulfillment or some belief of their own that's not accurate. And sometimes that can feel, you might have a very close relationship with that parent, or the parent's arguments or positions may be very compelling. But it's not helpful. If you're going to pick let's say with career and spouse, you're going to pick a career or a spouse and you don't feel like you're doing it for yourself. Or it's a decision I feel that's foisted upon you. Even if it's the right decision, it will be the wrong decision. Stop and think for a second. Obviously the spouse, you're going to, God willing, spend the rest of your life with this person. It's going to become the most important person in your life. You have to feel like you made that decision, that it was your decision, just for, to have, if you will, to use the Gemara Lashon, you have bialis over the decision, you have ownership over the decision. So it's really your decision, or the career. That's, you know, if you think about it, your career. That's what you're going to be spending most, especially, I guess, the men, but maybe even the women too. You're going to spend most of your waking hours of your adult life going every day to this. And you know how what a heartache is if you hate what you're doing. It's terrible. Imagine every day going and do something you abhor, or it's not fulfilling to you. So this decision, you have to feel like, Joan, is your parents' input important? Extremely important. But ultimately, you have to feel that this is your decision. But there's an opposite, there's another, if you will, minefield, a trap in this situation. Let's again give the example. Let's say a father wants a child to be a physician because he never succeeded as a physician, and he never had a chance to achieve this. Well, let's say your parents very much want you to marry such and such young lady, such and such young man, because they're friendly with the parents, and they'd love to have them as mechutanim or something like that. And in actuality, you would like to be a physician. And in actuality, this other person is very appealing to you. But you're going to show them. It's going to be like a doctor. There's an old story, in fact, some of you have heard about the story about this Jewish guy named Shapiro in Russia, who wanted to get out of Russia, and Jews weren't allowed out of Russia. And he heard that there was a forger who could make passports and actually, you know, put you a picture and give you a Russian name and put down your nationality as Russian. So he paid 1,000 rubles, he got a flawless passport with a Russian name, his nationality listed as Russian, comes to the border, nobody suspects a thing, just a matter of routine, the border patrol asks him, "What's your name?" And he can't remember his new Russian name. And the same thing, they say, "Sir, excuse me, what's your name?" And now he's going through the alphabet and he can't remember his name. So finally, at one point, now they're suspicious, says, "Sir, you better tell us your name." He said, "Look, I can't tell you what my name is. One thing I can tell you, it's not Shapiro." In a similar way, you're not going to not do something just to show your parents that they don't rule you, they don't own you. Even if it's something they want, if it feels right to you, don't get into that kind of situation. Again, there's something that I see, where it feels right and it seems to be the right thing, but I'm going to show him and not do it. So it has to be your decision, even if it happens to coincide with what they want. Now let me talk about a very sensitive issue, money. I actually have a rabbi I'm very friendly with, and he says, you know, it says, Ezo Shia Samech Mechalko, he says, that's Midaraisa, Midarabanim and Dach Geld. Money is a loaded topic, and again, especially today. And let me tell you something, I'll tell you what I tell the parents, and I'll tell you the flip side to you. I tell parents, if you're supporting your child, even if you're there in their 30s to 40s, if you're still giving them money, do one of two things. Either give wholeheartedly or don't give at all. The worst thing you can do, and again I see this often, is to give, but with hesitation. To sort of say, okay, here it is, so I guess mommy and I won't be able to buy that place in Florida. You know what that makes the kid feel like? And I'll tell you the same thing from your end. If your parents are still supporting you, and your parents are still helping you, and that's fairly common nowadays, given the economics and given the situation, it's their pleasure. It's what they are working for. You know, the Ger Rebbe used to say that he's waiting for that last einikel. He's waiting for that last grandchild. What does he mean? I have a guy, he's working, he's killing himself. He has enough money to live 6 lives. You ask him, why is he working so hard? I'm working for the grandchildren. Then his son is working twice as hard. Why? I'm working for the grandchildren. He says, waiting for that last grandchild who's going to get all that money. You know, that's what parents are working for, that's what they're struggling for, and if they can support you and they can make your life better, they're happy to do it. If they give it, if you ask or if they offer it and they give it, and hopefully they're giving it wholeheartedly, don't feel bad about taking it. That's the nature of the situation right now. But keep in mind one more thing. And again, we live in a time of unprecedented opulence. I remember there was a principal of my children's school who was a survivor and lived in Europe. And I remember, and he was at the time the school, he was the fundraiser, he was the housekeeping, he was everything. I remember he said to me, where he grew up, the biggest gebir, the richest man today would be an average balabas. Many people come from some huge amount of very successful, financially successful people, but always remember, there is always a limit. I'm involved in a number of organizations, and many of them are endowed by people who have money I'll never see. And yet it's an amazing thing to me when I go to board meetings, whatever, there's a very clear message. There's a budget. Live within your budget. I'll tell you one story, and I heard it in the public setting, so I'm not divulging anything. Many of you may know who Irving Stone is, from the Stone Chumash. He was a very, very multi-millionaire from Cleveland who supported many causes. And as some of you may know, Tell Stone is named after him. And the story of Tell Stone was that he bought that whole entire area, and he donated it to the Tel Yeshiva. For the Tel Yeshiva was going to actually relocate to Yerushalayim, or if Gifted took sick, it didn't work out, but they were going to relocate en masse to Yerushalayim and live there. And he gave it over to them as a gift. with attorneys and everything, and he had only one request in return. There was only one condition when he signed the contract. And the condition was that if any of his descendants, whether it's his children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, ever want to go to the yeshiva and can't afford the tuition, that they get tuition assistance. There's great wisdom in there. And this is a man who's a multimillionaire. So keep in mind, money isn't boundless. I'm running out of time, so let me skip. There are a few other points I'm going to get into, but I'm going to run ahead. Yeah. Let me talk also about a parental, maybe you can understand the parent's perspective. I don't know if there's research on this, and maybe David can comment on this. But people in their 40s, 50s, and 60s have a very different perspective in terms of risks and dangers than young people do. It is just a whole different perspective. People change as they get older. I often tell, one of the things I tell kids sometimes, that your parents could have been the coolest people in the world. Your father could have been captain of the basketball team, the most popular guy, and your mother could have been the most beautiful and popular girl in her high school. The moment you become a teenager, they become geeks. It's just written in the biology. It just sort of happens that way. But one more thing does happen as parents go. There's a sort of different sense in terms of risks and dangers. And this creates sometimes some conflict between the parents and children. So the parents will say, call me when you get home. Or don't drive so fast. Or maybe you shouldn't go out so late. Or these kind of things. And truth of the matter is, when they were young, they did the same thing. But as you get older and as you see what can happen in life and you get a certain perspective, you have a certain prudence, a certain more caution, you have a greater panorama of the world and awareness of many things that can happen. And therefore you have more of a hesitation about danger, and that's sometimes the conflict that exists between parents and children. Another thing is also, and again, you should need to understand parents just like parents need to understand you. A parent's nightmare, really, a real parent's nightmare, I mean, many kind of nightmares, but one nightmare is that a child can't take care of themselves. And that is actually the fear of the parents who do, again, Rahman al-Islam have disabled children. Who's going to take care of them? And that's the fear. And some of the reactions that parents may have to children who may be choosing more idealistic careers, and maybe choosing more idealistic lifestyles, and maybe even in terms of Aliyah, is that dread that how are you going to take care of yourself? I'm not going to be here forever. How are you going to be able to provide for yourself? And there is also a history. Now, you guys are two generations removed from the Holocaust or from the Depression, but I can tell you, as a child of Holocaust survivors, or a child of my father arrived in this country in the height of the Depression, that's like built into your psyche. And there is that dread. And sometimes if you are choosing a career or you are choosing a lifestyle that they may object to, sometimes that's the issue. Sometimes you may need to assure them, okay, it's possible I won't live as comfortably as you. But people in chinuch do to make a living. Today, I mean, I think it's much more rare today that yeshivas miss payroll and like it used to be. And people in chinuch can make a living. So even if their insurance is, yes, I'm going to work, I'm going to provide, I'm not going to be dependent on you forever, that may distill some of the tension. Another thing also, by the way, that's important to convey to parents sometimes and can reduce some of the conflict, that change isn't necessarily a rejection. That becoming, and today the case happens to be more firm, but some maybe even less firm, where somehow changing and going through a metamorphosis yourself doesn't mean that you're rejecting the values or the beliefs of the parents. And sometimes that's how it's perceived. Oh, I'm not religious enough. The way I raised you wasn't good enough. The truth is, again, we live in very different times. And there are many sociological reasons today why children are adopting perhaps more yeshivish or more religious positions. And I think, again, if you can avoid if you can address that issue, that it's not a rejection. In fact, sometimes it's an embracing. Because the parent, let's say the parent might have been more, let's say, typical, called modern Orthodox in Israel, I mean, I hate labels, and you're choosing more yeshivish lifestyle, but maybe the way in which the person was involved, maybe the causes that the person adopted, imparted upon you, for you, and the comparable experience for you and your generation is to be more yeshivish, spend more time learning. That it's not a rejection, it could even be an embracing of your values. And the truth of the matter is, and I know David speaks about this in his class, there are more commonalities between children and parents than most of them perceive. And that a lot of the differences are more chitzonius, or more externals, than really what really counts. One or two more quick points, and then we'll stop. If there are other people that are having an impact on your life, which can happen, it could be a Rebbe, it could be a Mora, it could be even certain friends, or a Rebbetzin, or a mentor, or something like that, let your parents meet them. Introduce them to one another, because sometimes there's this dread, who's this person and what kind of effect is he or she having on you? And if they get to meet the person and see that, the person is not, we're not talking about someone who's like involved in proselytizing or a cultist or something like that, but it's a very reasonable person. May have a slightly different approach to the world than you do. But if someone who respects you and values you, it'll distill that kind of conflict as well. If there is conflict, if there are differences, if there are people, sometimes they can get involved that can be buffers, that can distill some of that conflict. And I'm not talking necessarily even professionally. A very good potential buffer is an older sibling who may have had a different experience, but let's say who knows the parents, who knows you, who can sort of play a little bit of interference, can talk to the parents, can help explain your position, can talk to you maybe, and help explain the parents' position. That can be a very effective. Or it could be an uncle, it could be an aunt. Grandparents are not great. Grandparents should really be sort of removed. But if you can introduce someone, if there is conflict, if you can introduce someone who will not be your advocate, I'm not talking about being, to fight your battle for you, but can distill some of the conflict, that can be very helpful. Just a few things not to do. Okay? Don't tell your parents how to parent. First of all, you have no idea. You're not parents yet. But then you're touching also a very raw nerve. What you can do, though, I'm talking about, let's say, how to parent your younger sibling. How to be a parent. You're not in a position to do that. But what you can do is sometimes you can explain to your parents something the younger sibling is going through. Because you're close to them, to their age. You're more familiar with their milieu. So if you have some sense that the parents are misreading what's going on with the younger sibling, you can go in and say, Mom, Dad, let me explain to you what I think is going on with so-and-so, so-and-so. But don't dictate to them. That's just going to, even if you think you know, that's just going to cause conflict. And also, don't get involved in your parents' conflicts. And again, I'm not talking about anything even extreme. But let's say there are, as they've mentioned, even in healthy, strong marriages, there are areas of differences. Best thing is to stay out of that, is stay out of it, tell them that they're big boys and girls and they should settle this themselves. No, don't get involved. And try also, and this is maybe more an issue in situations where maybe one parent is missing or absent or etc., but don't try to be careful about not being what we call in the field parentified. In other words, don't being thrust into a parental-like role. Just one other very cute story. A number of years ago, they translated an IQ test into Yiddish. And they administered it to the Haredi community in Yerushalayim. And there were two areas where they got very different answers. One of them was a test called similarity. Some of those in the yeshiva, that's Sadashava Beinehem, where it's how two things are alike. And one of the questions is, how is an elbow and knee alike? Those are the obvious questions, that they're joints and they bend. And the Haredi community, the common answer was? You have to cover them both, yes. But the other one, which is a little bit more subtle but interesting, was there was a question in one of the tests, what do you do if you see a child on the street corner, a little child on the street corner, without an adult crying? So, of course, the obvious answer is, call the police, ask them where he lives, take him home. And the Haredi community, the common answer was, look for the older sister. But you try to avoid that parentification. One more thing, and I think we can close with that. I think it would be a meaningful way of closing. And that's also in terms of relationship with parents, is know your heritage, know your background. And now's a very good time. Talk to your parents, where they come from, where their parents come from, where their great-grandparents come from. No, get it in the information now. It becomes very important when you start becoming parents. It becomes important when you get married. That's really what makes us unique. I mean, I'm not the Bali Tshuva here, but one of the things that always interested me from Bali Tshuva that I've known, when you ask them, what prompted them? Well, and there are many different stories, but if there is a leitmotif, one of the common themes is, you're part of something. You belong somewhere. You're part of an authority, you're part of a heritage. I thought in terms of talking about parent-child relations in that context, I'd like to read to you from a small piece from Rav Yosef Ber Soloveitchik Zatzal, it's appropriate here in the Torah Maida lecture at Yeshiva, to quote the Rav. And this is from Man of Faith in the Modern World, Reflections of the Rav by Bezdin, and it's called The Experience of a Rosh Yeshiva. Some of you may have heard it, it's a famous piece, but I'd like to read it over. And it's in an article where he talks about Yaakov as the first Jewish grandfather. The old Rebbe walks into the classroom crowded with students who are young enough to be his grandchildren. He enters as an old man with wrinkled face, his eyes reflecting the fatigue and sadness of old age. The Rebbe is seated and sees before him rows of young beaming faces, clear eyes radiating with the joy of being young. For a moment, the Rebbe is gripped with pessimism, with tremors of uncertainty. He asks himself, can there be a dialogue between an old teacher and young students? Between a Rebbe and his Indian summer and students enjoying the spring of their lives? The Rebbe starts the shiur, uncertain how it will proceed. Suddenly, the door opens and an old man, much older than the Rebbe, enters. He is the grandfather of the Rebbe, Reb Chaim Brisker, 1853 to 1918. It would be most difficult to study Talmud with students who are trained in the sciences and mathematics were it not for his method, which is very modern and equals, if not surpasses, most contemporary forms of logic, metaphysics, and philosophy. The door opens again and another old man comes in. He is older than Reb Chaim, for he lived in the 17th century. His name is Reb Shabtai Kohn, known as the Shach, who must be present when civil law, Dine Mamonis, is discussed. Many more visitors arrive, some from the 11th, 12th, and 13th centuries, and others harken back to antiquity. Rabbeinu Tam, Rashi, Rambam, Ravid, Rashbar, Rabbi Akiva, and others. These scholarly giants of the past are bidden to take their seats. The Rebbe introduces the guests to his pupils, and the dialogue commences. The Rambam states the halacha. The Ravid disagrees, sharply, as is his wont. Some students interrupt to defend the Rambam, and they express themselves harshly against the Ravid, as young people are apt to do. The Rebbe softly corrects the students and suggests more restrained tones. The Rashba smiles gently. The Rebbe tries to analyze what his students mean, and other students intercede. Rabbeinu Tam is called upon to express his opinion, and suddenly a symposium of generations comes into existence. Young students debate earlier generations with an air of daring familiarity, and a crescendo of discussion ensues. All speak one language, all pursue one goal, all are committed to a common vision, and all operate in the same categories. A mitzvah, collegiality is achieved, a friendship, a comradeship, of old and young, spanning antiquity, the Middle Ages and modern times. But who are Kates? This joining of the generations, this merger of identities will ultimately bring about the redemption of the Jewish people. It will fulfill the words of the last of the Hebrew prophets, Malachi, and he shall turn the heart of the fathers to the children and the heart of the children to their fathers. The messianic realization will witness the great dialogue of the generation. After 2 or 3 hours shiur, the Rebbe emerges from the chamber young and rejuvenated. He has defeated age. The students look exhausted. In the Masorah experience, years play no role. Hands, however parchment dry and wrinkled, embrace warm and supple hands in a commonality, bridging the gap which separates the generations. Thus, the old ones of the past continue the great dialogue of the generations, ensuing an enduring commitment to Masorah, the Ruach Kodesh. And this is the secret that will lead to the messianic redemption. Thank you. Okay, any questions, rebuttals? Dr. Potts, we're happy to take them.
Questions on either topic? Yes. Right, right. So the question is, which is a very good question, is, you know, it's easy to say that minor religious differences shouldn't be a deal killer, but how do we define it, and how do we know it? And sometimes minor differences might reflect an underlying gap that's much bigger than reaches the eye. And I think that that's where the vision of the future that I talked about, Shaya Astra, for some of you may have heard speak on this topic, talks about doing this. So it's like you try to project, as you're getting serious, let's say you're going from the early stage to a stage where you're really talking tachlis, right? And the way it would show itself, you want to see, is this something that would show itself in day-to-day life? Would it show itself in terms of wanting to send children to a totally different kind of yeshiva? So, for example, if because of what seems like a minor hashkafic difference now, later on you might want to send your kid, you know, one of you might want to send your kid to a Beis Yaakov, and another kid send you know, and the other member of the couple wants to send the kid to a Ramaz, that would really speak to a Ramaz or Hafter or Mercer Hebrew Academy or Tarvadas, I don't know. In other words, that would speak to some differences that really would be much more significant. And I think you have to do that in every area. In other words, like underneath every minor difference, I think the way to examine whether or not it reflects a deeper process that suggests divergent dreams is try to project yourself in terms of, you know, again, how would a Shabbos table look different? Okay? How would the home look different? And that's where, but let's say the differences are between, you know, plus minus one. You know, are you going to send your kid to this center school or that center school? Or, you know, to this base Yaakov or that base Yaakov? That would be, and that's just one example. That's sort of, in other words, I think that you're right. It's the devil's in the details. So you're right. But those are the kind of discussions that have to take place in a variety of areas. Yeah. Yeah. Yes, you're saying that there might be a fifth dimension that, let's say, are you somebody who makes decisions guided by Das Torah? Are you somebody who makes decisions based, not just makes decisions, but sort of like your philosophy, your basic philosophy of life, where you filter everything is through the prism of learning and Torah and what a Rebbe's guidance is, versus somebody who's the more modern philosophy that just where that would be totally alien. I mean, I would put that under divergent dreams and philosophy. You're saying that it may be important enough to require a fifth guideline. Is that what you're saying? I don't know. That's what we mean. In other words, you're right. In other words, like if, for example, you have somebody who doesn't, you know, who's totally different in that area and has a totally different kind of religious philosophy about the role of a Rebbe in somebody's life or the role of learning or whatever. To me, that's what I meant by the first. And that's what I meant by shared dream and vision. But yeah, that's, thank you for, you know, clarifying that, right? Does that sort of address what you're saying? What am I missing? Things that become, maybe we can get a little bit of a discussion going from everybody. I mean, things that I think down the road become important. Yeah, go ahead. But wouldn't you know that if you're on the same page with somebody on that? Just from discussion? Yeah. Right, so I think that's specific guidelines are hard to tell because in a way we're talking about a lot of gray. I'll give you an example. Robert Goldsmith, so many of you have heard talk on this topic, speaks in public. I've heard him speak about how sometimes when he's in Eretz Yisrael, he himself doesn't go to the movies, but he'll take his wife and the wives of other Rosh Yeshiva, he'll help them figure out what movie to go to and take them away in the car and learn while they're in the movies. You know, those are the, there's a reason why he says over that story. He says it over because he believes, I think, he wants people to realize that's not a deal killer. That's not something that really matters. I mean, it doesn't, as long as you're on the same page and you're giving similar messages to your kids about it and that there's room for divergence there, that doesn't have to be the source of problems. things that are more telling have to do with it. It's a whole different approach to life. That's different. But where it is depends on the person, depends on the personality, depends on how you handle differences. But you're right. I mean, it's a complex, very very difficult to break down kind of process. But yeah, thank you for that. Or for Dr. Blumenfeld. Yeah. Say that again.
But that's your question.
Yeah. So the question is, how does having a platonic relationship? Platonic isn't the right word here. How does having a completely non-physical relationship? How does it differ in terms of relative to those who have? It's interesting. I just heard. Dr. Michelle Friedman gave a talk yesterday on, she did research on 400 mikveh-going women in the Orthodox world, and she looked at their sex lives, and one of the questions she asked was how many of them were physical with their future husbands before they got married. And the percentages are surprisingly high across the spectrum, and she was seeing people ranging from Hasidic to more modern. So let's just say that there is a higher percentage than one would think that are not able to withstand the temptations and are not able to keep a relationship totally without some form of physical contact. With that being said, there's a lot to be said for what that does to relationship. Learning how to relate and be emotionally intimate rather than physically intimate is a wonderful preparation for a good marriage. Sex has the tendency to distract us from whom we really are. There's some research that's come out in the last year that shows that the average young adult in the United States wishes that they had waited longer before becoming sexually active. There's other research that shows all kinds of negative outcomes that come from becoming too sexually active at too young an age. One of the challenges in any new marriage is how to manage the tension between the period of the month that you're physical with each other and the period of the cycle when you have to relate and be intimate in non-physical ways. Building up that muscle is a very healthy thing to do. It's admittedly very difficult. And it's admittedly, but it forces, I think what it forces is very healthy. It forces words. It forces expression of emotions. It forces a closeness that doesn't get confused and confounded by the physical. Now, the problem is very hard to do. Dr. Friedman's and Dr. Yehuda, her colleague, co-researcher of statistics, suggest that it's very difficult to do. But still, many, if not most, do it. So, at least going from her anonymous questionnaires. Do you have any thoughts about it, though? And I'd love to hear from Dr. Blumenthal about this.
Very quick answer. And obviously, I'm not going to divulge who this is, but I once, a professional, was speaking to someone who grew up in a home of a fairly well-known Rosh Hashiva, and she told me that obviously her parents never engaged in any kind of public or physical displays of affection. But she said, growing up, she was the choice of a mikveh necklace, which was something in the air. So there's a lot you can relate physically without touching.
I had a question about relating emotionally with the parents. As a child, my kid is very emotionally dependent on his parents. I feel that even though they're all the parents, they feel very emotionally attached to the child. And as one grows older, the teen, the child feels separated in the end. So that we can give up their son.
I think your question was the answer. Yeah, the nature of the dependency changes. Well, obviously, first of all, the young child also, the need for the parents is greater, right? they need parents even just to take care of them across the street. You know, they, as you get older, the actual need becomes less. So it becomes less of a need-based relationship. Also, the emotional attachment takes on the form less of dependency and more of just actual, if you will, attachment, love, and hakaras hatov. Because as you get older, you come to appreciate more the sacrifices and what parents did. So I don't think you can look at it quantitatively, that the emotion, that the amount of emotional attachment changes, but the nature, or let's say put it this way, the ingredients, what's behind the emotional attachment changes, which I think is sort of implied in your question. Well, anytime you change, you know, it's an interesting thing in terms of any, and this was alluded to in terms of what I felt it was mentioned in terms of John Gottman's research. There's always tension when you go through a change, any kind of growth. In fact, you won't grow unless there's tension. So invariably, when you go from one phase to another, there's an element of tension. Tension can express itself internally. You know, you can get stomach aches and you can have a lot of anxiety, but sometimes it gets expressed interpersonally, through conflict. So it's not uncommon that is, I mean, that's the whole thing with adolescents. Some of the friction between adolescents and their parents is partly because of the changes that are taking place. So as the nature of your relationship changes, understandably that there might be some tension. Again, same thing applies in parents and children, like with couples, that if you know how to address that tension, if both, let's say, if there is a tension as the nature of your relationship changes and both the parents and the children come to realize where this is coming from, then it leads to a more mature relationship. Okay, guys, yeah.
That sometimes the guys are moving my... It's interesting. I mean, I'm not sure. There's an interesting finding in the research. It shows that for women, the relationship causes the attraction. For men, the attraction causes the relationship. Okay? And partly because of that, there often is an out of sync process going on where the guy is more the pursuer and quicker, probably guided less by in-depth stuff and more by the physical attraction part. Now, so there's that part that I'm hearing that you're talking about. Sometimes there's sort of like an out of sync nature to the guy often being faster to attach. The key, though, is in terms of that disconnect, sometimes it means that he has to pull back and has to slow things down a little bit. But the key there, the key challenge for the couple is what psychologists call metacommunication, the ability to communicate about communicating. The ability to step back and say, hey, wait a second, let's take a look at this, you know, and to talk it out. Again, that's a very good predictor of success in a relationship. If they could talk it out and she could say, look, I may like you one day, but I'm not quite there yet. You're going a little too fast for me. And he could hear it, that's a very good sign. If instead it's all going on in an underground way, it's going to lead to a premature terminating of the relationship in a way that may not be necessary. Yeah. Thank you. I know you were going to ask something. Hi. Yeah, good question. The question is, all these questions are good. And come up with anything that I'll tell you a little bit about the. All right. There is similarities. I didn't go through that, but just sort of to. Read you a quick summary of that research on similarities as a predictor of happiness in a relationship. Actually, it is somewhat of a predictor. So, for example, successful couples are similar in a wide range of personality and cognitive traits and intellectual traits. So they're more or less, it's better if you could be chavrusas with one another. I don't mean literally, although sometimes that happens also. So not only sharing the same interests, but sharing similar personality traits and abilities is helpful. But with that said, obviously some of the most successful relationships also feed off certain differences. So you need both. But I think that if you have somebody who's on widely diverging intellectual levels, if being smart intellectually is important. Now, sometimes it isn't. I know one couple where the guy is very, very bright. You know, he has a PhD and from an Ivy League school, and his wife is a little, I don't know how to put it, they used to call it, dull normal in the old IQ test. Now it's called low average. But she's really not all, I think he was attracted to her because he didn't want an intellectual challenge. He was a little bit in need of being in control and was not looking for a intellectual sparring partner. He needed to be listened to and admired. And it seems to work. It seems to work. It's been a long-term successful marriage. So you can't always say, I don't know how you feel.
No, I think that's a good point, Senator, because I find myself flashing back to a light, sharing some personal things. I have an aunt named Aleha Shalom, who was from Germany and a real yekka, who was very extremely, meticulously from, but very invested in staying here in America, and was very, had really no interest in Israel. She ended up marrying my uncle, Yibad Lachaim, who was a diehard labor Zionist, was actually the first Israeli representative to the World Bank in 48 or in the early 50s, and real labor, total chiloni, etc. They got married, and they made a compromise that they'd have a religious home in Israel, and actually had a lovely marriage, and it worked out. So I mean, I'm not saying that I agree with everything Dr. Paul was saying, that's certainly the research, but there are a lot of factors, and I think you have to think, the old line, the first rule in this profession that there are no rules, and these are generalities. There are many exceptions, and there are many other factors that sometimes override what might be the statistical norm.
Okay.
Go ahead, I'm back. What role can a child have in the boys' home? What?
Yes. I was saying I wanted to talk about. Yeah, remember there was the third thing I was going to talk about, and I didn't. Maybe it might have even been the second. The question is, what? Let's say somebody is setting you up with a child from a divorced home. Do you say, whoa, forget about it, this is a bad sign? And I'm so glad you asked, that's so important to address this. The research shows very clearly, and I know this very deeply from a lot of experience with a lot of situations like that, that on the contrary, very often, children who grow up in homes where they're exposed to a high conflict divorce end up making better wives or better husbands because they understand the importance of shalom bayit. The question shouldn't be, is he or she the child of divorce? The question should be, how do they handle this? How do they handle growing up in this home? Now, that becomes an important topic of discussion. So if let's say you're going out with a woman who went through a very tough time in terms of exposure to a high conflict divorce, at some point when you're getting to that level of intimacy, talk about it. If she says, oh, it didn't impact on me at all, it's nothing, I don't want to talk about it, I'd be nervous. But if she says, wow, it's really tough, and she talks about it, and she talks about how her vision of the house she wants to build is to never expose, is to put Shalom Bayit front and center. And she's, because of what happened, is going to be very different. The research clearly shows, and clinical practice really shows, and all my experience clearly shows, that on the contrary, they can become unbelievably wonderful partners. So the key is the ability to talk about it, the ability to name the monster. The research shows that psychologists call it the magic of the ordinary. It's so common for there to be resilience in the face of going through tough times in life that it's by far the road. Now, with that said, Are there people who are really damaged in a way that will impact on our shore? But the key is the ability to talk it out and to show that they're able to grow. It's the Nate Nisayon kind of dichotomy I talked about before. Yeah. Oh, they might be, sure. The research, longitudinal research, let's say, for example, Dr. Wallerstein in California, he followed a group of 100 kids who were children of divorce very intensively through their childhood into adulthood, finds that when they hit the age of most of the people in this room, with the, that actually they are more likely to be gun-shy, they're more likely to fear intimacy. But again, that's something that isn't there in every case. And even when it's there, it doesn't mean that it can't be overcome. Yeah. Thank you. Good question.
Based on that question, does it make a difference how old a child was when they were born?
It probably does. And the there's, again, a lot of very interesting research on this. And sure, it'll matter. That those of you who've taken some courses with me, actually, Dr. Blumenfeld is going to be talking about this topic at the pastoral psychology class in 2 weeks. There is stuff on it, and it has a different impact on a preschooler versus an adolescent, let's say. But again, in terms of the bottom line, you could expect that resilience is still the norm, no matter what the age is. One of the toughest ages, though, to experience a parental divorce is adolescence. But again, that's also an age when the kid is able to talk about it and figure out how they want to handle things differently in their own marriage, often very, very successfully. I'm sometimes amazed at the beautiful success of marriages of people who've grown up in those kinds of homes. And I'm often amazed at how it shines and surpasses the typical marriage because they don't take anything for granted. So, yeah. But again, I don't want to be a Pollyanna. You know, there is a subset and it has to be addressed. If I was going out with somebody like that, I'd want to talk about it at some point in a gentle, supportive kind of way. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think I'd like to hear from Dr. Blumenthal about that, but I mean, I think the general guideline is that that as long as it's there, as long as it's there sometimes, okay, the chemistry grows with time if other things are in place. And then once you're married and the relationship, you know, sort of settles into a real, see, it's never tougher than it is during, in some ways, I think. You know, there's something very artificial, like you were alluding to before when you were asking about, you know, the tensions of a non-physical relationship. That's tough. It's not natural. It's really not normal what we ask people to do. That's why so many of us believe in short engagements, because it's not the way we're wired. It's not the way we're designed to be. Once you're in a marriage, all that becomes a non-issue. I find a guy who are worried about chemistry, as long as the chemistry is there sometimes. Once they're married and are into sort of like, you know, a set kind of relationship where they're able to have a physical component to it, that almost always typically disappears, you know, and becomes a non-issue. You know, ein simcha keheter hasveikos, okay? So, I don't know, can you talk about that a little bit? Yeah.
I'd be inclined to agree also. I think you can't create chemistry that's not there. So I would be inclined to think that when it's not, it might have more to do with some anxiety or tension about the whole process. One of the things that I've done with young, it's usually men that come to my office and are not sure, and when they come with a list, you know, the pros and the cons, I will tell them to throw away the list and ask them questions like, well, it's a 4-hour date, did it seem like, you know,
1 hour or 12 hours, you know, how often are you thinking about her, you know, what perfume, do you remember the perfume she wore, you know, the kind of, the sort of intangible. Just also to address the earlier question in terms of the issue with divorce, is one more factor that I think needs to be mentioned, is that sometimes you have to look at not just the divorce, but what was behind the divorce. You know, sometimes there are issues that led to divorce that are more important than the divorce itself, and that in terms of both the positive and the negative kind of sense, and that I think is also should be a consideration.
This will be a correctly for more your topic.
Okay.
You're discussing situations where the parent and child will either be, you know, at odds with each other about certain major life decisions. What if they're not? And yet still there's a lot of tension, like, for example, a son is getting married, and there's still tons and tons of tension between the mother and the father. Can you maybe expound more on that?
Well, you mean in terms of that decision, is this like a silent disapproval?
No. Meaning, yes, she's a wonderful girl, yet still, I mean, I think I've seen this. Mm-hmm. Yet still, the parent's having a very, very difficult time with the fact that
I see what you're saying. Okay, sometimes it's a funny thing, you know, someone's talking about the two terrible things that can happen to him in life. One is never achieving your dreams, the other one's achieving your dreams. Sometimes when you reach another milestone in life, you can have a very sort of ambivalent response. Sometimes for parents, the marriage means losing the child. And even though that's irrational, doesn't make sense, and it's what you've been dreaming for, but they really feel now the child's really gone. Sometimes it also means that you're sort of reaching another stage in life. You're now going to be a father-in-law, a mother-in-law, and that it sort of like reminds them of their aging or something like that. So you can have reactions, not necessarily to the partner you pick, but just the very fact that now you are facing that. Of course, then there's the other issue, which is you have to pay for the wedding. You know, that might be also... Actually, I remember I was once at a bris, and the grandfather of the baby was speaking, and he said, you know, we say at a bris, k'shem sh'niflan for a bris, k'shem sh'niflan for a chuppah matzim tovim. And the question is, the kid's 8 days old, what happened to China with the Torah and the chuppah? He says, and now, finally, the grandfather, he understands it. He says, k'shem sh'niflan for the bris, just that the grandfather paid for the bris. Then he says, oh, he's going to pay for the wedding, he's going to pay for the bar mitzvah, you know. So there could be any number of issues that have really nothing to do with your choice. And does that address the...
Sort of. What I meant to say was more from our perspective. I mean, mm-hmm. If it's not necessarily something that's really tangible, I don't know how often this is, more mm-hmm. like, okay, it's very expensive wedding, things like that. I observed a little bit later personal experience that there's mm-hmm. still something, and let's say it is the wedding go aspect of that, you're up to a certain point in life. Would you have any significant perhaps view of that from a child's standpoint?
You ever see the Pink Panther?
Yes.
Okay, remember the dog scene?
I saw the new one.
Come on. The scene, he's walking in the park, and the guy says to the dog, and he says, does your dog bite? He says, no. And he pets the dog, and the dog leaps up and almost rips his shoulder off. He's standing there, and he says, I thought you said your dog doesn't bite. He says, yeah, it's not my dog. That's not your dog. If it's their own personal matters, if it's the money, it's not there. If it's the new stage in life that they're in, whatever it might be, if it's not related, really, to, you know, to you directly, it's not your dog. It's not your issue. Really, it's really not your issue. Yeah. Go ahead, yeah. Well, this 35 hasn't had the last part, huh?
No, but the son or daughter would ask the other boy for the full 35 hours, but there's two issues, and you have 2 feet, they want to get into it, but the parents just come out of their house, and they're like, mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think, and that's the impression I have, and I know that Dr. Felker mentioned this in his class, very often the perception of the schism and difference that exists is greater than what really does. And I think if you try to diffuse it of the emotionality and the fear, I think what needs to be said to parents is this is not a rejection of you. I might have embraced something else, but I'm not rejecting you and your values. I think if you talk about where you stand, you'll find you're not that different. I would also say, as I said earlier, that if it gets too intense, introduce another party. Sometimes just having, as I said, the buffer, the lightning rod. Okay, go ahead. Say
yeah, I was going to say, there's a need for a, and it's one of the points I wanted to make. Sometimes it's very helpful to have a dating mentor. I don't mean you have to have a formal dating mentor, but first of all, if you're going out, talk to your parents. Ask them, if you can, I mean, if they're talkable to, ask them what they think is important in a good marriage. They have there's a lot of wisdom there. You know, they've been through, even if you think they have a terrible marriage, and they're particularly good people to talk to, because they'll be able to tell you things that are particularly valuable to hear. So going to your parents for feedback and for advice in this area. Now, it means overriding the initial adolescent pullback. So most adolescents don't want to have anything to do with their parents. But now you're hitting a new stage of life where it makes sense to be open to them. Now, if you feel you can't talk to them about this stuff, as many people can't, then find some adult. Recruit somebody. Recruit somebody who could be a Rebbe, or it could be an aunt or an uncle, or somebody in your shul, or a friend's parent, and talk to them. Now, there are actually now dating mentors who are actually trained dating mentors that are out there, and Yeshiva University is thinking, we're thinking of having, there actually is some active planning going on now to finally do something about this issue, and maybe, you know, have some kind of like a shadchanim, like there's stuff under advisement now, and all kinds of interesting ideas that have been proposed that's being looked at, that hopefully, my guess is that within 6 months there'll be some active role that Yeshiva will probably be taking in this area, I hope. But the bottom line is, think about recruiting somebody to talk to, because very often you can't do it alone. So and that person might be a help with parents, if parents are in such a different world from where you are, based on the shifts that Dr. Blumenthal was talking about.
I got a text message to say we have only one more question.
Yeah, these text messages are amazing. It's coming from administration. Coming from the 12th floor, I think. Yeah. Yes. Well, I'm sorry, a little louder, I'm sorry. Yeah, good question. The question is, are there books that could be recommended about communication skills? One of the things that comes to mind is Gottman wrote a book called, it's an interesting book, it's called He and Some Other Guys, The Prep Program.
Oh, yeah?
It's very interesting. You have this Orthodox Jew writes a program on premarital therapy that is implemented by the Catholic Church around the world. Not the entire Catholic Church, but every country that's adopted it. Any country in Europe or every state that's adopted it here, where a priest will not marry a Catholic congregant without going through the PrEP program, has a significantly lower divorce rate and higher rate of marital satisfaction if you go through the PrEP program. So you have this Orthodox Jewish design program teaching you how to communicate that, unfortunately, we ourselves, as karma chalo notata, we ourselves don't necessarily use. Now, hopefully it's going to start to change a little bit. There is a from-based PrEP program. But with that said, that's the book I'd recommend, because it's simple, it's to the point. It's called PrEP. If you email, you have my email. So just email me, and I'll give it to you. And also, I'll give you. I'll be able to give you some recommendations on communication. There are a number of really good books, but communications within a couple. I think the PrEP book is probably the best. So I'll let you know. Yeah. Yeah. It looks like we have to. Let's have one last closing question, or what does the board say?
Stick around,
there are
questions in the back, I think, and I think the doctor's
there. Okay, so we should end it, or?
Yeah.
Sorry.